Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about Heat Rock, you know, combustible listen, a hot record. And today, we will be tripping back to 2012 and the soundtrack for the film Mosquita y Marie. The movie tells the tale of two teenage girls from Huntington Park, Southeast LA represent,
yes,
who navigate their friendship amidst school, family, community, and their own feelings for one another. The soundtrack is tapped into the melange of musical intersections that flow through the neighborhoods of LA that most other movies seem to forget even exist. And across 10 tracks, you get everything from Venezuelan chill wave to Baja dream pop to a Oaxacan electro cumbia to this lovely main theme done by LA's own Ryan Beveridge.
To talk about the soundtrack for Mosquita y Marie, we invited the film's director, Aurora Guerrero. Mosquita y Marie is one of the best films I've ever seen. Its story about two young women, a developing crush between them, and their lives, culture, religion, and love in Huntington Park pulled me in and held me close. I had the good fortune of seeing it at Sundance in 2012. What a time. What a time. This film is an award-winning, compelling narrative with a compelling soundtrack of hometown artists like Viernes 13 and La Poblesca. Those things work together to underscore the beauty of Los Angeles, the textured complexity of relationships, and the allure of youth, and the importance of sonic realism. I walked out of the screening feeling proud to be a Los Angelino, excited to be a woman of color, watching a woman of color story come to life, and obsessed with the mix of ska, punk, rock, and swoon that I heard, simply because Aurora Guerrero's ear is as incredible as her eye. Welcome to Heat Rocks.
Wow. Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Normally, our guests talk about an album that they discovered or came across through some serendipitous set of events. But in this case, because this is the soundtrack for your film, it's an album that you obviously played a role in helping to shape and or at least compile. And I'm wondering, when you sat down to think about the music for the film, what were your motivations? What did you want to be able to hear and have, more importantly, what did you want the viewer to come away with sonically from it?
Putting this album together was one of the funnest things I got to do on this film.
Mm.
And when I first, so I'm not from Los Angeles. I'm from the Bay Area.
Whoop, whoop. Whoop.
And, but mad respect to Los Angeles, you
yes.
know. It's been my home away from home. And so I got a lot of respect for it. And one of the first communities I came across when I was introduced to LA was Huntington Park.
Mm.
And I remember going from downtown on Pacific Avenue, which cuts through Huntington Park, like the heart of Huntington Park.
Yeah.
And the windows were rolled down and I was with my homies and we come through Huntington Park and it was just, it has its own soundtrack. Like you literally have to do that. You hear the cumbia, you hear the ska.
Yeah.
Mostly all in Spanish. You look out the window, it's all dark brown faces, all ages. And I felt like I was transported to a community in Mexico.
Mm.
Like the border just erased itself.
Mm.
And it felt very familiar to me. It felt like home to me. And so I knew that I wanted to pay homage to the identity of Southeast LA as much as I could. And so I had to do my research, really, to be able to capture those sounds. And so that was like, so I knew that I wanted to do that. And I also knew that I wanted to approach Mosquita y Marie in a way that did not feel familiar to the other Mexican-American movies that have been done.
Yeah.
That largely are English-based language, or the scores are very largely heavily guitar like strumming thing that somehow landed in the ether of Chicano
right.
films and Chicano films. Like it just It's just what you always hear. And I was like, no. I think that there is this idea that all brown communities are the same. We all sound the same. Yeah. We look the same. And, you know, I wanted to capture what I was experiencing of Huntington Park in Southeast LA, which felt to me familiar, but also unique in its own way. And I wanted to honor that and capture that. So I remember talking to Ryan Beveridge, my composer, and saying, absolutely no strumming guitars, man.
Save that for Coco.
Save that for Coco, yes. Yeah. No, and I'm not trying to hate on the strumming guitars. It's all good.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was just like, no, yeah. no recycling of anything right. in this film.
Right.
This is going to feel really fresh and different, but real. And so I told him, I said, you know what? Go to this community. Mm-hmm. He lives here in LA. I want you to walk through Southeast LA. I want you to walk through Huntington Park. And I think that I want to capture the practical sounds of this community. There are a lot of train tracks that run through Southeast LA, Huntington Park. Like, what does that sound like in a score? Like, how do we bring in the identity of Southeast LA into the sounds of this film?
Yeah, if I can just follow up real quick, it's that to the extent that I think people outside of Los Angeles, actually, frankly, even people in Los Angeles know anything about the Latinx community here, it always fixates on East L.A., Boyle Heights, Montebello. And despite the fact that Southeast L.A., you know, Bell, Huntington Park, et cetera, these are, in terms of density, in terms of population size, are just as large, if not larger, probably larger, right? And as I was alluding to earlier, but somehow completely invisible from the public imagination and geography of the city. And there is a particular East Side sound that has been developed over many, many years. And I think what was striking to me about the soundtrack, and this reflects, I think, the point you're just making now about wanting to capture a distinct neighborhood that is not just because they're both neighborhoods that have a lot of brown people in them. The sounds don't sound the same. The traditions are not going to be the same. And just the mix of demography and diaspora that flows through these different parts, I think this is what makes the soundtrack so special, is that it's rooted in some place that is hyper familiar to anyone who grew up there, but doesn't ascribe to the same kinds of expectations that we have from, let's say, one or two generations of films that are about Chicanos and Chicanas set in Los Angeles. But again, this is not an East Side film, and it's not an East Side sound.
When I presented this film, and I've gotten to travel around the world with this film, I never say this is an East L.A. story.
Yeah.
I say this is Southeast L.A.
Right.
When they write the synopsis of the film, many people assume East L.A.,
yeah.
Boyle Heights, and I make them rewrite it. you know what
yeah.
I mean? It's
yeah.
like, no,
yeah.
Southeast L.A. has its own history.
Right.
And I think that's just important in terms of really educating folks on that all brown people aren't the same.
I was going to ask, but I think you answered the question. At the screening, I remember thinking, who's the music supervisor, right? I was so engaged because these were bands I hadn't heard of before. How did you find some of these bands? Because you didn't have a music supervisor,
no.
right? Just your composer. How did you find some of these bands, or were you listening to any of them before you started working on this?
Yeah, no, actually I didn't. The film was originally set in the Bay Area. Mm. Which is where I'm from. And coming from the Bay, there are different sounds in the Bay Area. Like, I was influenced a lot by hip hop.
Mm.
I was listening to Run DMC, Lighter Shade of Brown.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And so I had sort of thought of different music when the film was set there. And then I found out that I couldn't afford to shoot in my hometown. And I had to bring it down to LA. I had been living in LA for some years.
Yeah.
So then I had to shift gears and brought it to Southeast LA, Huntington Park. And so when I did that, I tried to really incorporate the best way I could the community into the process. And in doing that, I got to meet a lot of young people. And we started actually a program in conjunction with the making of the film. And this was something that the community asked of me, because I came to the community and I said, through this nonprofit, Communities for a Better Environment, CBE, and I said, look, I'm brown. I come from immigrant parents. This community feels familiar to me, but I don't want to come in here, make my film, claim it as my own, and go out in the world and not have had a conversation with the community. And so this nonprofit was like, yeah, you know, we appreciate that. This is a story surrounding or centered on youth. We have a youth program. We think you need to do a presentation to these young people. Mm. Ask them for their blessings. Mm. And I was like, right on, let's do it. I was the most nervous in this pitch that I've ever been in any other pitches. Room packed with young people. And I basically told them what the story was about and why I was in love with Southeast LA. And all these young people were like, hell yeah. This is like so our story. This is so beyond, you know, we're ready for this. What do you need? And so we started this conversation. And I said, well, I would like to get to know your community through your eyes. But I also recognize that I'm asking you all to give me something. What can I give you? And they said, all right, well, we want to be able to tell our stories about our community. Mm. So we want to learn about what you do. And I was like, yeah, we could do that. So we set up this program in conjunction with the making of the film, where it was like a mentorship program specific for young people in Southeast LA that were interested in movie making. Anyway, so I had about, I don't even remember how many mentees I had. But they were working with me, and one of the things that I asked this young man, Johnny Rios, to do was to put together a playlist of music from Southeast LA. And he was like, oh, yeah, I could do that. I was like, cool. So I'm doing my thing, you know. And then he goes, hey, I got that playlist for you. I was like, awesome. So I get in my car, I put it in, and it's primarily ska. I did not grow up with ska. I knew East LA had a very strong punk scene,
right.
But I had not really been exposed to Southeast LA ska. And I was like, what? I was blown away. I was like, this is my jam. Like, this is, I love this. I really heard a fusion of influences that were both American and very much Mexican or Latin American. I went to Johnny and I was like, Johnny, this is beautiful. Like, you're going to have to connect me to these bands. Hmm. And he's like, oh, well, I belong to most of them. And that's when the door opened. It was Johnny Rios who introduced me to the ska sounds of Southeast LA. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and Johnny's in the film. He plays the male love interest in the film. So that's how I came across a very grassroots, very young, very talented community of musicians and artists.
How did you decide which jams went where? Because usually that's the music supervisor's job. So how did you decide, after you got this playlist, what was going to go where?
To me, the way I was seeing the music was that it was, I saw it as like their voiceover, the lead character's voiceover in particular scenes, because there isn't a lot that is outwardly spoken, particularly between the two women or even between the women and the parents. And I kind of grew up with like that, you know, where there's just a lot of silences around what's really going on, out of fear, just this awkwardness. And so I wanted to explore that silence between the two girls and within their families. And so I was like, how do I talk about what's really going on? And to me, music just made sense. That's how I grew up. I had to find music that was my soundtrack, you know, for what was going on inside of me, because I had nowhere to put it. You know, the story of these two young women is my story, and I very much lived it like they did. And so so I needed to find the songs that were their soundtracks, their voiceovers for those moments.
I'm curious that if you had been able to set the film where you originally wanted to, which I think would have been in the Mission District in San Francisco, which is where you were born and raised, at least as a young child, how would the soundtrack have been different? What kind of songs you might you imagine have come to play instead had it been there?
Yeah, I think that probably much more hip hop.
Interesting.
I think that's what I heard growing up in the Bay Area,
yeah.
Very much with the, you know, I grew up in very black and brown communities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And maybe some of the new wave popish stuff that I was also into, and definitely Prince.
Yes.
So had the film, again, been originally set in the Bay, would it have been more of a period piece as opposed to the movie that you made, which seems very much set in a contemporary moment rather than, you know, a neighborhood of the 80s?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
When I first wrote it, it was set in the 80s.
And yes, I
didn't mention that. But yeah, that's what it was set in the 80s.
Yeah.
I was going to tell my story, my time period, my hometown. And when I couldn't shoot it there and ended up in Los Angeles, and I looked around and I was like, it doesn't make sense
to set it back
in the 80s. I don't know LA 80s.
Yeah.
When I originally found out I couldn't do it in the Bay, I was heartbroken. I really was. It was hard for me to shift originally. It took me a little bit of time.
Mm.
But in hindsight, having made the film that I did, I'm just like, this is the film that needed to be told.
Yeah. It makes me think, too, you know, you and I are of the same generation. In fact, we were at Berkeley at the same time. So shout out to all the ES kids out of Cal from the early 90s.
Woo-hoo.
And that the primary films around Chicano and Chicana life that would have come out in the 90s, a lot of them, and to be more specific, the ones that were being produced by Hollywood studios, a lot of them were very much, especially musically, least of all, seeped in a lot of nostalgia. So you would have heard Earth Angel on three different films, right?
Sure.
And I think in a lot of ways, moving the film, just both in terms of the location as well as the temporal era, and capturing, as we've been talking, a much more contemporary moment, it really marks, to me, this very striking difference between oftentimes how Chicanx culture gets represented in Hollywood, which always does seem to be facing backwards. And I mean, certainly that's not fully invented. There is a lot of backwards looking, a lot of nostalgia that you find in different elements in particular of Chicanx culture. But again, I think it's so refreshing to have something that is not beholden to that particular tradition, it's not least of which is because we've seen it so many times repeated in different ways since the 90s, films that are focused on that community in some form or other.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that sort of it defines the difference is that I feel like the cinema of say, the 80s, 90s, that was Hollywood Chicano, very male.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
That it was also this rejection of, you know, your parents' culture.
Right, generation gap type of thing. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Very much like, that's not me. I am American. And
yeah,
American
right.
means that you speak English and, you know, you're not connected to your immigrant identity. That's old school, old world. And I was watching these films, and that was not my experience at all. So when I was watching those films, I was like, something feels, to me, felt off. You know, I was like, wow, it feels like there's a rejection there. And I think that was certain people's experience.
Sure.
It just wasn't mine and a lot of people around me. It wasn't our experience. The way we were flowing Spanish and English, you know, eating hamburgers and our black beans. And so when I went to Southeast LA, that's what felt so familiar to me, was that these young people are not rejecting at all the influences of their parents in those ways culturally. And so I really wanted to capture what felt to me more fluid.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with filmmaker Aurora Guerrero on the soundtrack to her movie Mosquita y Mari after a brief word from a couple great Max Fun podcasts. Don't go anywhere.
Hi, I'm Biz.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting.
Whether you are a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent.
These are really hard questions.
They are really hard questions.
I don't have any answers for them.
I don't either.
Sack of garbage.
No.
Ah! The end of the show will just be 5 minutes of Biz and Teresa crying and screaming until the outro is played. So great.
I wish I had something.
I know. Like, you have nothing to say to me.
I'm just dealing with this reality.
And I'm not saying anything helpful to you.
And I'm just not saying anything helpful to you.
Yeah.
So join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I love it.
Oh, good
man,
stuff.
Every time.
Well, I hope that you're enjoying this podcast you're listening to as much as we are pretending to. But anyway, why not listen to another podcast too? It's called The Flop House.
And on our podcast, we have recently watched a movie, often a bad movie, and we review it on our podcast, but mainly talk about other stuff and, I don't know, hang out.
It's all about hanging out, feeling like you're being with your best friends. Who are your best friends? Us three. Dan McCoy, Emmy Award-winning writer for The Daily Show, Stuart Wellington, owner of the best bar in Brooklyn, Hinterlands, and Elliot Kalin, former Emmy-winning head writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, former head writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Return, so many things. Author of the upcoming children's book,
All Right, that's enough.
The Elliot's credits just go on and on.
Yeah, but if you like the idea of listening to three funny guys talk about bad movies, then why not come over and listen to The Flop House? It's available at MaximumFun.org or wherever fine podcasts are found.
So get out of here.
We are back, and we are talking about the soundtrack for the film, the 2012 film, Mezquita y Marie, with filmmaker who made the film, Aurora Guerrero. This may be an unfair question to ask, but if you wanted to pick only one song off of your soundtrack that represents, or would be, I shouldn't say represents, would be an entry point into everything that you're talking about, all this complexity, what is a song that you would suggest that people start with in order to get a sense of that feel?
I think probably one of the ska songs. Mm. I think La Pobresca song, Las Cruces de Tijuana, amazing song, instrumentally, where you hear the brass, you hear the influence of mariachi, you hear the influence of big band music from the 50s from Mexico that I grew up listening to because of my grandma, my mom. And you also hear the lyrics that are in Spanish, but they're talking about immigration. They're talking about that bittersweet experience where, as young people, they're talking to their parents, because they're talking about, they're questioning why. Why come over here when it is so hard? That money you've invested, you'll never see again, and the dreams of your children are dead. Like, it's dark.
Yeah.
It's dark. You know, and that's the draw to ska and punk, right? It's that being able to tell it how it is, keep it super real.
Express anger.
Yeah, and express anger. And I feel like, you know, that's such a great song to come into and feel the young people of Southeast LA's identity and what they have to say, what their experience is, and just their talent.
Yeah.
I would say start there.
Do you remember the first song that you said yes to?
Ooh, that's a great question.
I love all these songs, but it's really hard to say. But I might have to say it was Carla Morrison's song. Ooh. Tomes a mal, disfruto luchar por lo que quiero, sea lo que sea, yo lo tengo, me parto en tres, en dos o en cero. And Carla Morrison's voice is so haunting. And I am haunted by my love story. And she's also talking about loneliness, isolation, restlessness around it. And I feel like, because this is Yolanda's song, Mosquita. That's her track. And I feel like this is something that she's struggling with. And she's lonely and isolated because the world around her has expectations of her that she's struggling with. She's not quite feeling like they are hers. And I think that that really fuels that isolation and that sense of loneliness. And it isn't until Mari comes around that she begins to feel like someone sees her.
I loved, again, going back to the indie music, I love that it was indie. Growing up around black and brown folks, I heard a lot of oldies. I grew up in the late 70s and the 80s. So I grew up with a lot of oldies, the gangsters that I knew. I grew up in Crip neighborhood, so that's what we all had in common. We all loved oldies. And so there was a part of me that was expecting to hear a little bit of that. And maybe that would have been different had it been a period piece,
sure.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
But what I liked was in this that you were not only introducing artists, you were introducing a community that a lot of us, you know, were not aware of. I knew about Scott. I didn't know the tie-in about punk. So if I could ask about some of those tracks, your choices there, any favorites amongst...
I love all the ska, for real. They really do stand out to me. There's a fun one that Viernes 13 put out,
yes,
called Pierdete Chica, which translates into Lose Yourself, Young Woman. And what Viernes 13 is talking about is they're asking the young women, or they're putting out this challenge of like letting go and letting the music just kind of free your body and free your soul. Although this is what Mari is listening to, because this, she has her, you know, her Walkman, and she listens to music, and ska is very much something that she's introduced to Mosquita. But this is a song that really speaks to Mosquita needing to be in her body and free herself of anything that is sort of keeping her caged. And Viernes 13 is a wonderful group who really a lot of people feel are one of the godfathers of ska in Southeast LA. And they came up in the 90s primarily. And so I really felt like I needed to sort of honor a bit of, you know, the history of ska in Southeast LA.
Right.
Viernes 13 was someone that I felt like I needed to pull in.
I'm wondering, were you approaching these artists yourself directly in wanting to license their songs?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm assuming probably, at least for most of them, this is the first time they ever had a placement like this. And what were those conversations like?
Yeah.
In terms of, like, what was your pitch? What kind of questions did they have for you? I mean, outside of the money aspect, I'm sure, but just...
Yeah. You must love your jobs, the music supervising. I mean, just, it's like playing detective, you know, like, especially if you're into getting into the crates and pulling out stuff that is indie, you really have to do your research and really have to go out of your way and be creative about how to even reach people.
Yes.
You know, with Southeast LA, I'm in the community and I have direct ties. So I was able to get on the phone with Viernes 13, or in many cases, it was all via internet, where we were emailing each other or Facebooking or whatever. And most of these young people were extremely excited to be a part of this project.
Yeah.
And it was, some of them had, they didn't have like a real recording. You know what I mean? Like they were recordings that were live at one of the backyard, scene, like things that they do. And so they had to go into a studio and record. And that happened with Mi Corazón Es Para Ti.
Wow.
Raíz Orgánica. And also with Pobresca. I was like, I have no money for recordings. How are we going to do this? And they're like, oh, we got a friend in the garage. And we just like padded it up and we got this. And I was like, okay. Like I was sweating bricks with some of these bands just because I was on a time crunch.
Right.
We had already found out we got into Sundance. And so I was like, I really want to include your music. So so it was a bit of, just being on top of folks, making sure they were taking care of business because they also had their own young lives to live.
The joys of DIY.
Right. You know? It was way out of my control, too. So I was just like praying to the goddesses that they were going to help in this situation. But some of the other ones, like, say, for example, the other song that I really love, which is El Día Previo by Algodón Ejepicio. He's from Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never heard his music. Part of my research was, again, trying to find musicians that were indie and that had unique sounds. And when I heard his track, I heard his track through an online cultural magazine called Remezcla.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
You gave a great interview to them that talks about the music of the movie, too. Yeah.
So they are at the forefront of providing a platform for a lot of these indie global Latinx musicians. And so they put together like their top 20 lists. And so I came across it, and on there was Algodón. And I heard his song, and I loved it because it took me back to a soundtrack that I was really into when I was young, which was Pretty in Pink.
Mm. Oh. We talked about that in a previous episode. So
you did.
Yeah,
we did. Oh, yeah. Pretty in Pink. I loved the soundtrack in particular. The movie was problematic, but the
love. We talked about it.
Yeah. I mean, Mosquito Mari, in some ways, was me in conversation with Pretty in Pink, where I was like, you know, young love is so complicated for people of color.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was watching Pretty in Pink, I'm totally going off on a side tangent.
Go ahead.
In Pink, to me, because I was in my own angst around my love that I was experiencing, that I was so yearning and hungry for representation somewhere. And Pretty in Pink was like the closest thing I had.
Sure.
And it was all white people.
Yes.
They really didn't talk about anything other than being popular or not popular.
Right.
And so I had issues around, you know, dealing with class and race and gender and sexuality. Nowhere in there.
Yep.
But I love their soundtrack.
Yes.
Right. And that kind of became my soundtrack as a young person as well. And so when I heard El Día Previo, it made me feel like this is my Pretty in Pink moment right here, because it is so dreamy and it has that new wave-ish feel that is Algodón style. And so now it was like, now I have to find him. How the heck am I going to find him? And it was just looking online. At that time, it was Facebook. I think it was SoundCloud, just different ways of tracking folks down. But the moment I did, everybody was gung-ho for it.
That's great, yeah.
Yes, the moment, and I was very clear, this is a story about a young love, two young brown women. Yes, I don't have a big budget. It's okay. I didn't feel good about that because I recognize, you know, artists need to sustain themselves.
Right.
It's their heart.
Of course.
In that sound. And, you know, so humbly asking them to grace me with their music. And I never, you know, I never encountered any sort of resistance at all.
Yeah.
It was only the ones that were already attached to label.
Yep.
Where the negotiating had to come in. My biggest one, which is not on my soundtrack, was the Hello Seahorse with Julieta Venegas. They were my biggest artists and probably my biggest challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah, Morgan is just straight up just nodding, you know. so heavy right now. She understands. She understands.
I feel your pain, my friend.
I have two quick follow-up questions. If you actually had used that song and replaced it for a song in Pretty in Pink, which scene would you have used it
good
for?
Good question.
Oh, gosh. That is a good question. And if I could remember the damn movie.
My 13-year-old
In terms of the Pretty in Pink, literally the sound, the yeah. song Pretty in Pink would be the song that is El Día Previo
okay.
for me.
Oh, so you would just, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But in terms of the scene within the movie.
Well, I mean, that song opens yeah. Pretty in Pink.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
It does, right?
It does,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, thank you.
With the sax version of it. Yeah. The other question is, and I apologize for taking us down a Pretty in Pink tangent here.
No, it's okay.
Where do you stand on the should Andy have ended up with Ducky debate?
Oh, no. No. Ducky was weird. I mean, he's cool. I mean, I don't know.
He's both. He's cool, yeah, but he's also weird.
Yeah, he's complicated. Yeah. Yeah, but I felt like, of course, I'm like, you should have ended up with the home girl.
Yeah. There it is. There it is.
Yeah. But that was my brain was always going there.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I was just like, yo, ride solo.
They did have the best relationship in the film.
Like her and Ducky?
No. Her and her friend. And
oh, the, yeah.
Oh, the record store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love those. Yeah. Are my favorite scenes.
Yeah.
The record store scenes. Yeah, when the dudes were not in there mostly. But Ducky, yeah. Poor Ducky.
When artists come in to talk about albums, I ask if they had to describe the artist in question, which song on this album best gets them into the mindset? We had Michelle Ndegeocello on here. She picked Purple Rain. So we were asking her if she had to turn someone onto Prince, which track would it be? So I have to ask about this soundtrack. Which one of these tracks is the most about you?
Mm.
The most about me.
Ooh, I like this.
You got deep. I think for in that time, even though ska was not in my cipher, the one that probably best captures how I was feeling was probably Mi Corazón Es Para Ti, Raíz Orgánica. Mi corazón es para ti. Mi corazón es para ti. And I say that because that moment in the film, she has a realization. I mean, she's been going in that direction that she has feelings for her, but it almost feels like it's an affirmation, declaration of my heart is yours. Everything that you bring out in me. That is me. No one in this car is seeing. Mm. And I need to honor that. Thank you. Thank you for helping me see that. That is what that moment in that song really is talking about. Mm. But I do have to say that all of me is in every one of these tracks.
Good answer. Good answer.
Really. I mean, yeah. Every one of these. Mi corazón es para ti, mi corazón es para ti, mi corazón es para ti, si este corazón es para ti, mi corazón es para ti, si este corazón.
If you had to describe this soundtrack, your soundtrack, in three words, what three words would you choose?
Fluidity, honor, and love.
Mm.
I have to say thank you for giving me one of the best moments at Sundance. It was my first Sundance.
Mm.
I was there as a music supervisor on a film called Middle of Nowhere.
Love that.
Thank you. And it was, when you mentioned being seen, it was a moment, watching that film was a moment where I was allowed to see myself, to represent a community in Los Angeles that a lot of people didn't really know about. And I felt in that way you gave me access to that community and enabled me to see myself. And that moment of not just seeing the film, but as I said in the intro, of being a woman of color, watching you shine in that moment was very, very, very powerful. So I thank you for one of the best times I had at Sundance. I remember you in the white cap. You had the all white fit on.
Yeah.
And
nice.
So it was a very cool moment. Thank you for that.
Well, I really appreciate those words because that, you know, sometimes that's the goal that filmmakers have. I have that maybe one person in that audience has that opportunity to see themselves to a certain degree is what I strive for, where you feel validated. I didn't really have that when I was growing up, so that's one of the reasons why I made this film.
Very connective tissue for me, how similar black and brown communities are, how much we have in common, especially in Los Angeles. It was really powerful for me. So again, thank you so much.
What are you working on now, if you can share?
I've been sucked into the TV world via Miss Ava DuVernay, who we have in common, Morgan. and it came from that Sundance screening where she had her film there. I had my film, and she went to see my film. I don't know how she did it. She's so busy. But she did. Remembered it. She put Queen Sugar together. She gave me the opportunity, and it opened the door. Yeah. And now I am stepping through, helping other folks tell their stories as a director, but also writing my own for television and still continuing to write for film.
Yeah.
So always the stories I want to tell centering people of color, women, queer folk, working class folk, like just keeping it real like that. Those are the stories that I want to tell. So.
And where can people find more about you online?
Mostly Instagram.
Okay.
I feel.
What's the handle?
I think it's AUROG 2004, AUROG 2004.
Okay.
I think that's where you can really get a sense for who I am. Is that more of like my family and my kid and some of the projects I'm working on.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure for sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes. Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan. Our booking producer is Shannon Deloria. And engineering and editing producer is Christian Duenas. Laura Swisher is our senior producer, and exec producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles, where there's nothing but Sonora love.
I like that. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Heat Rocks Pod. You can find a link to our Facebook group on our webpage, which is heatrockspod.com. That's where we'll post show notes for every episode, including a track listing of every single thing you've heard today and more goodies. Again, that's at heatrockspod.com.
Big thanks to our most recent 5-star iTunes reviewer. It's Bad or Bod, one of those two, but either way, thank you. If you have not had a chance yet, please do consider just taking 30 seconds out, going to iTunes, going to our website, and leaving us a review, since it is a crucial way in which new listeners get to find us.
We'd also like to thank our social media fam. I want to call them fam now, not just fans, fam. Social media fam out there, including Haiti Kadri. Thank you so much for your shout out, for checking out the Egyptian Lover episode. Mm. Great, great episode. Also want to thank Chris Is Floating in Space. Okay, shout out to Chris. Want to thank Bomar Blog, Claire Vaughn. Thank you, Claire. Andrew Mullen. Also want to thank Flower Emoji, D-Bot Flower Emoji. I love it. Want to thank Hannah Sidibe for shouting us out, shouting out the episodes she did with Oliver. Also want to thank Chase Gibson at The Chase, Tony Papa, Jack Splash, oh, and Pop Rocket. Thank you for the love, Pop Rocket.
Yeah.
JJ All Day. And finally, we want to thank Miss Rhubarb and Violence Jones. We do so appreciate the tweezies and the retweezies. Good to see you, Oliver.
Good to see you too, Morgan. And one last thing. Here is a teaser for next week's episode, which features editor/writer/podcaster Chris Ryan of The Ringer talking about the Rolling Stones' epic Exile on Main Street.
Basically, this record sounds like the best band in the world in a room together playing these cuts live, and is in fact piecemeal cuts of various takes of one guy on drums and then he disappears for 3 days and another guy comes and finishes it, or Richards is playing bass, or, you know, Jimmy Miller is playing drums, the guy who produced the record. And then it all gets finished in L.A. months later by Mick Jagger, largely, at Sunset. So it's just this miracle where it's this collage of different times and days and performances that comes together to sound like the most organic, live-sounding record I've ever come across.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned.
Listener-supported.